This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
Hi, everyone. I'm Beth Twomley. I'm a professor of psychiatry at UCSD. Known Danielle for 20 years. And have known some of these folks for a long time, too. And so I'm really excited to introduce Dr. Ellen Lee, directly to my left, professor of psychiatry at UCSD and chief of geriatric psychiatry, and Dr. Sid Zizek in the middle, professor emeritus of psychiatry at UCSD. And I've known Ellen and Sid for decades, respect them both so much. And let me tell you, you've got the heavy hitters here. They are just experts, high-level experts in their fields. And then we also have Marty Kranzberg. Thank you so much for joining us today. She is our boots-on-the-ground expert, and she'll be talking about her own experience. So welcome to all of you. And who would like to kick off our discussion of mental health and resilience?
So, hi, everyone. Thanks for sticking around in the post-lunch lull. So my job today was to talk a little bit about psychological resilience to sort of kick off our panel, because I think that's so important when you think about mental health. And it's been alluded to so many times throughout the morning sessions and the keynotes. And I thought it was a lovely chance to sort of jump in at this point. So I wrote down some notes because I don't want to forget. Dr. Molina had a lovely definition of resist, adapt, and recover for resilience. But I think of resilience in multiple levels. You know, there's sort of like my first stage is like the Rock of Gibraltar, where something never moves, never changes, weather, wind, whatever, it's still the same, still there. And then we have this, you know, bouncing back, which Dr. Whitson talked about. So like Weebles, they were these toys from like the 70s and 80s. They were like egg-shaped, and you could knock it over, and it would come right back to its position. It would never fall. So Weebles wobble, but they never fall. So that's sort of bouncing back, coming back to baseline. And then the one that I think is most important for us in mental health is post-traumatic psychological growth. So how do you thrive and become something even better, stronger, and more than what you were than originally? And so I think that's kind of where I would love to focus our, you know, some of our, what we think about with psychological resilience today. So just thinking about how do we become more than what we were originally? I'll stop there. I don't want to take too much.
Sid, do you want to?
Hello. Yes. Thanks. So I've been studying grief for most of my professional life, which is probably over 50 years now. And it wasn't until today that I realized that grief and resilience are the same thing. Danielle would know that. Resilience is adapting to the curveballs life throws us and adapting, hopefully, with growth and even stronger than we were before. And that's what grief is. Grief is adapting to loss. And my task is very easy today because I'm speaking to a room full of experts. Everyone here is an expert based on your lived experiences with loss. And we face losses every day, whether it's we're losing names, pronouns, words, keys, or, you know, maybe more important losses like hearing, teeth, vision. All of us experience loss and have learned to adapt well to most of these losses. Bereavement is a special kind of loss, and that's losing somebody who dies, an important loved person who dies. And bereavement is the aspect of grief I'm going to mostly talk about today, and that's, you know, how do we adapt to the loss of a loved one, which can be one of the most earth-shattering losses we face. And again, everyone in this room is an expert on bereavement. Who here hasn't lost a grandparent or a parent? Most of us have lost siblings, friends, acquaintances, colleagues, multiple times. So we're all experts, and we're all here, and we're still learning, and we're looking up, and we're enervated even at the end of the day. So we're resilient, and we've grieved. So what I say about grief is not going to be news to everybody because we are all experts. So what is grief? Well, the question I get asked most about grief is probably how long will it last? And so the bad news is probably forever. You don't get over it. You get through it. And grief, I think of grief in two major forms. One is acute grief, the real pain of grief that we feel soon after somebody we love dies, and that pain can go on for a long period of time. And then the second phase is what we call integrated grief. And that is, you know, grief doesn't disappear and go away, but it becomes integrated into who we are in our daily lives. The pain is less, the preoccupation is less. We go on and we find new sources of strength in relationships, et cetera. So acute grief transitions into integrated grief. Acute grief can be one of the most painful experiences we ever have. It's very different for everybody. It's different for the same person over different losses. And it isn't invariably terribly painful. When I lost both of my parents, who I loved very much and they loved me, the pain wasn't that great. They both lived into their 90s. They had lived very full lives. They were ready. The time was there. On the other hand, when I lost my sister not too long ago, it was very painful. She wasn't ready. It was a real tragedy that she died when she did and how she did. So it varies considerably. And so we all grieve very differently. There are some commonalities. One commonality is there's often a very initial stage of denial and shock. Oh, no, how could this happen? Is it true? Really? Those kind of questions, which are probably healthy to have initially to help us kind of bear the significance of the loss itself more slowly by having it integrate into our minds a little bit more slowly. As that lessens, the yearning and longing for the person who died may be the hallmark of grief, and a host of other very painful emotions, like, you know, sadness, anger, guilt. If we often will think, "Well, I should have done something differently. I could have done differently. Why didn't I know?" Anger can be at the person who died. Why didn't you take better care of yourself? Anger can be at other people who didn't provide the care we thought they should. Anger can be at ourselves, which is what we call guilt. Anger can be at God for letting such a horrible thing happen to such a wonderful person. So anger is kind of out there looking for a place to put it. There's a host of other negative feelings, confusion, hopelessness, helplessness. There's also physical symptoms that go along with grief very often. Pain in the heart, heartache, an emptiness in the gut, difficulty sleeping, not eating for periods of time. So physical symptoms are also there. And there's also an intermix of positive feelings. Many of us here have given eulogies. And I think for most of us, including me, the funniest I've ever been is giving eulogy for someone I loved and I missed dearly. So positive feelings are also part of it. Sometimes we feel guilty about having those positive feelings, but they're there. Sometimes the positive feelings are a sense of relief because somebody has died of a chronic painful illness and they're better off no longer suffering in that way. Sometimes the positive feelings are recollections of wonderful memories and deeds that the person did. So those painful feelings, positive feelings, physical feelings, there tends to be the preoccupation with the person who died in acute grief shortly after they've died. It's all we can think about. Often that preoccupation comes in waves, kind of like a panic attack. And those waves initially are autonomous. They last a long time. They don't need to be triggered by anything. Over time, they become less intense, less frequent, more triggered by other things. And the waves are often, again, intermixed with positive feelings as well. So What happens, though, eventually is that acute grief transitions into the integrated grief. We don't have to will it to happen. We don't have to make it happen. It happens. It happens over time for most of us. The problem is, in integrated grief, it doesn't go away. So we're always going to miss the person. And aspects of that acute grief response can come back from time to time, like anniversaries, like special occasions. But they don't have the intensity. They're not there every day. They don't interfere with our functioning. And they're often not just negative and painful, but bittersweet, tinged with positive feelings as well. So grief, acute grief transitions in integrated grief. In integrated grief, the person lives on in our lives, in our hearts, in our souls. The pain is attenuated, lessened, but still in the background and ready to come back from time to time. The what we can do to facilitate that process from acute to integrated grief. Oh, and I might say that we don't. Most of us, when we've lost someone who loved us, have lots of friends and loved ones trying to help us by telling us get over it. It's time to move on. Don't listen to any of that nonsense. It has its own time course for people, and that acute grief, that transition can occur in weeks, in months, sometimes in years. But for most of us, it occurs, and it occurs quite naturally. There are a couple components of that transition, and that's where grief and resilience become the same thing. We have to adapt to the loss. We adapt to the painful emotions, to the grief itself, and part of that is accepting the reality of the loss, accepting the consequences and the finality of the loss. That's hard. That's part of the work of grief. That's part of the adaptation, and that's resilience, allowing ourselves to grieve, allowing ourselves to cry, allowing ourselves to have those really painful emotions. Another component that we adapt to is forming a new relationship with the person who died. They don't just disappear from our lives. They live on in us forever, in our memories, in our deeds, in our minds. For me, in my grandchildren's eyes, when one of my granddaughters sings, boy, I immediately think of my mother. Not only would she have loved to heard her sing, but same voice, same uninhibited loudness, etc. Or another, my grandson, when I see his kindness and generosity, that's my dad in him. So we form new relationships with the person who has died in our hearts and souls that work for us. And the third component, often the most difficult that we have to adapt to, is life without the person in our daily lives. And we have to form a capacity for moments of joy, happiness, new relationships, strengthening old relationships, and being able to kind of move on. And that's sometimes the most difficult part. And in order to do that, we have to be patient with ourselves. We have to provide compassion for ourselves. We have to recognize our vulnerability and take risks. But for most of us, that does occur. And we find ways of making meaning in that loved one's death and moving on in our own lives, often with newfound capacities of compassion, of values, of understanding the value of life, of understanding the value of relationships, and really honoring the lives of people in our lives who have died. And I think I've probably spoken too long, so I'm going to stop there. Love to hear your story, and then we're all going to take questions and comments.
Well, hi, I'm Marty. I'm new to this. This is the first time I've ever done this. So I have a lot of notes, and as I was coming to what I was going to say, they kept getting longer and longer and more strategies that Danielle wanted me to share with you. So first of all, I'd like to say that I am all about body, mind, and spirit. Now, the idea is to get into the concept of well-being. Now, we're all talking about longevity,
But longevity is a curse if you have a poor quality of life. I don't know about you, but I know people who have committed suicide because of their quality of life. Very hard to deal with after that. So what I say is that it's your job to find, to make your life meaningful. Some way, you've got to have the key element, I think a key element for resilience involves finding meaning, which is part of mindfulness. And mindfulness, mindful, F-U-L-L-ness, is really a major strategy in my playbook. And I have a lot of strategies, so you may have to stop me and ask questions. But first, my first disclosure is I had six sessions of 50 glorious minutes with Danielle Glorioso as part of Dr. Jesty's study on loneliness. Now, this was done during the pandemic, and what a blessing it was to be in that study. And in case I don't get to the bottom of my list of things, one of the most important things I want to tell you all today is get in a study. Their studies are great. There are people doing studies. Be a part of a study. It will change your life. One of the great things about being in the study with Danielle was that we were doing the work with intention and accountability, which is what one of our speakers talked about the first time, in the first session. So what we did in this study is we delved into the concepts of gratitude, empathy, compassion, and self-compassion, along with value-driven work. And you may have heard Danielle mention that. Doing things that are in alignment with one's own self. And so one of the things we did in the study is we set up goals and we mapped a process to achieve them. And this type of exercise is really very, very empowering. We did deep breathing and stress management. You've heard about the importance of stress and how it ages you. So you have to become an expert on managing your stress. And I have a lot of strategies here because these are key elements of the study that we did. So now for me, you should understand that I live alone. I've never been married. I have no partner. I have no children. All my family lives somewhere else, originally from St. Louis. But many of these people and my family have moved elsewhere. My immediate circle of family is small and dysfunctional. And even at best, they're distant. And the majority of the people who were in my psychic support network system, they're no longer on this plane, as my grandfather would say. So I welcomed the support along with the strategies to help lift me up from grief, which is what I was experiencing so, so badly at that time, where we all were going through grief. We were all losing so much during the pandemic. So grief can be debilitating. And a very important strategy for this is to be in community, which made it very difficult during pandemic because community was hard to do. So keep in mind the practice of mindfulness should you consider doing any of the therapies that I might have to suggest for you. And that means when I say therapy, I mean behavior. That's what therapy is. It's really about behavior. So you've got mind, body, and spirit coming together in order to produce well-being. Psychotherapy, talking with someone, especially someone who acts like they're concerned, and journaling and writing poetry, very, very powerful. An attitude of gratitude. And a lot of times we talk about the gratitude journal. It makes a huge difference. Just do it. Finding and living your purpose. Our last speaker, Dr. Newman, mentioned purpose. Acknowledging your purpose can change. So your purpose may change throughout life. So acknowledge it's going to change. If you thought you were one thing, you may be something else. Get and take the right drugs. If you need them. I mean, they can help stabilize you to be more productive and help you achieve well-being. Now, I practice a lot of non-pharmaceutical strategies. I was trained in the expressive arts therapies. I was trained in dance and movement therapy, which was a really important part of my life. And I did work on a geriatric psych unit in that area. That's another bunch of good stories. Art therapy, the creative process is incredibly healing for grief to be able to do art therapy. And during the pandemic, I have a brilliant art therapist, Ellen Spirit from the California Center for Creative Renewal. And in talking to her on the phone, the one important piece of information and advice she gave me was do art. Do art, make art. Knitting and needlepoint is therapy. That kept my mother alive for 50 years when she was deemed with a terminal illness in her 30s. She lived to 88 years old. She buried two husbands, three rabbis, and a couple of doctors. The cultural arts. Theater is therapy. That was the original purpose of theater. You would come, you'd get the catharsis. Theater is therapy. Music therapy, incredible. Sound therapy. I've been studying sound therapy now. The sound bowls, the toners. I talked to the researchers at the Stem Cell Institute, how the vibrations of sound, how that may have a healing effect on you. I'm saying, try some of these things that you may never have thought of. Humming and tapping, that's another one. I've been getting stuff in the thing, humming, something about humming is changing the vibration in your body. Singing. And the amazing, the music therapy, it has a biochemical response. Laugh therapy. Norm Cousins in the 1970s, he kicked off the movement, the anatomy of an illness. Laughter and a sense of humor is very important. Meditating, movement, exercise. Now, I know we're talking about mental, but the actual physical movement is going to change how you feel and include it in, like as somebody was saying, stand and brush your teeth with one foot. Learn to include the exercises that you need to do to make yourself stronger in your ADLs. Another thing is flexibility, body, mind, and spirit. Action. Just keep moving. Balance. Balance is very important. And remember rule number one, after the age of 70, don't fall down. Activity affects your blood chemistry. Breathing affects your blood chemistry. Your chemistry is going to affect what's going on in your mind. And all of that goes back to integrating body, mind, and spirit. Microbiome. This is so new. We're here. There's so much research being done here. Take advantage of it. But the microbiome is key. Sleep is key. All of this changes your chemistry, which is going to change your mind. I think as Kurt Vonnegut used to say, bad chemicals make you crazy. Bad thoughts and bad chemicals. That's crazy. Live a life that is restorative. Physical activities, sports, not so much for me, but it really offers a lot of benefits for a lot of other people. Social dancing will do it. I do aqua jogging, being in the water. I just love that. Yoga, practice the principles. And it changes as you get older. When you used to think you could do some of those yoga things you can't do anymore, well, remember the principle of it. You do what you can do, and you adjust. Respect your body. Yoga teaches you to listen and respect your body. And so you have to learn to adapt. You have to maintain your health and be resilient. And I had a wonderful advice from one of my chiropractors. If it hurts, don't do it. If it feels good, don't overdo it. Hugging. Hugging is a very, very important thing to do. I myself, when I was working on the geriatric psych unit, did not have a license to touch people. Unless you are a therapist licensed, you cannot. But as a minister in the Universal Life Church, my ministry is a ministry of love and hugs, and I am literally practicing my ministry whenever I hug you, and it is absolutely legal for me to lay hands on you because I am a minister of love and hugs, no less. Petting animals, the power of pet therapy, nature, being in nature. Richard Louv, right here, he wrote the book on being in nature, how important that is. Bird watching, just sitting there and watching the birds. I feed the hummingbirds, and I mean, it changes your attitude. It changes how you feel. I just saw something on CBS Sunday Morning, explore.org. It's a nature cam. You can just sit on TV, put it on TV and watch nature that way. Pain management. Pain management is the key to resilience. When I studied palliative care at San Diego Hospice, when it was first being taught to the medical professionals, they taught us to understand that if a person's pain is out of control, death becomes a viable choice. And if you can control the pain, you control that attitude to be able to function and go on in this world. So I'm also an advocate and a devotee of physical therapy. Understand where you're holding your pain. Work with your doctors to notice that the pain and how that works within you and the power of getting touched. Massage therapy. Hands-on or even hands-off. You know, some of these energy workers where they don't even touch you will make a difference. Diet therapy. Again, microbiology and chemistry affects everything from mood to movement. Anti-inflammatory. This is the key. And this is what they're talking about. A lot of the disease processes are all, and pain and many things are all about inflammation. So how do you turn down the inflammation in your body? And the way to do that is to become an expert on that. So be an expert on that. It's anything that's firing you up is damaging you. CBD. It was my cardiologist that turned me on to my CBD, I want you to know. I was complaining about the brand that was too expensive that my chiropractor turned me on. He said, oh, no, it doesn't have to be that expensive here. He pulls it up on his computer and shows me exactly to CV Sciences plus CBD oil. It's changed my life. Retail therapy. Oh, we could go on for a half an hour about retail therapy. I mean, as shopping for anything. My mother lived so long, I thought it was about if you buy a lot of wonderful things, then you have to stay alive to enjoy them. Right? Clothes, anything. I like getting a makeover. I do recreation. My avocation, when they ask me, you know, what's your hobby? Recreational shopping at the cosmetic counter at Bloomingdale's. You know, let them do a makeover on you. It'll change how you feel. It'll change your life. Horticultural therapy, culinary therapy, gardening, cooking, eating therapy. Well, I'm of the vent that's really important. That'll change your life. Neuron firing. Pay attention to neuron firing. Learn new stuff. Maybe it's a language. Some of us don't want to learn a language. I'm busy learning from the Schwab guy about investing instead of trying to learn a new language. And now it's had enough to learn there. Reading is good therapy. Mindfulness and balance. Mantra. Self-talk. Your self-perception needs to be positive. It needs to have a positive direction. I think of myself as a healing machine, and I tell my doctors that all the time. I'm a healing machine. Oh, okay. Well, let's work together on this. You're a healing machine. And it really helps. And again, this really important thing I have written again is gratitude, the attitude of gratitude. Humor, keep it, engage in it, pass it along. I personally practice irreverence. It amuses me. Talking to strangers. And some people consider talking to God. I put that in the talking to strangers part. I talk to customer service people. Like I said, I'm alone. I don't have anyone to talk to. I am happy to be on the phone and talk to the customer service person. I vent at them. Sometimes I yell at them, and I apologize, but I do that. Giving stuff away. One of the things that I really find a great strategy is giving stuff to people. I learned this from the Hare Krishnas. I used to be in advertising sales, and they taught me, you cannot get through a man's brain until you get through to his stomach. And they always would feed you when I would call on them just to sell them something. So I learned the importance of giving things to people. Now, the two things that Danielle really, you know, noticed that was fun. One of the things I do is I have Rice Krispie treats. And I give those to people. I don't even ever eat them. And my friends who are, you know, the active agers get very upset about oh, you're enabling people to eat crap. But you know what? They don't have to eat it. They can give it to someone else. And most people are really happy with a little Rice Krispie treat. It's already wrapped up. It doesn't go bad in the car. The other thing I have is hearts. I have these little heart stickers. And if you go to Scripps and you see anybody on their name tag with a little sparkly heart on it, oh, you can know Marty was there talking to them. But you'd be surprised. It's just a guy that checks you out in the grocery store. What color heart do you want? And I let him pick a heart. Oh, you made my day. And that makes my day to see somebody get so overjoyed with something as silly as a little heart sticker. Oh, are you a teacher? No, I just like to give people things. Find new friends. Explore new groups, find communities, reaching out, asking for help. It will change your life. If you're all stuck, ask for help and see how that will change your life. Helping others. One of the things that we found when I was doing work with hospice is I used to be on the bereavement team. Whenever I was feeling bad, I would call up people and they'd somebody die and I just let them talk. And that made me feel better. And so I have the people that I call and just checking on people, reaching out, practice dialoguing with people, talk to people who are different from you, learn new things from others, spiritual practices, relationship with God, kindness, compassion and empathy. Manifest this by making it an action. Last week, the other day, I learned about blessing people. Oh, that was a whole new thing to be able. And I thought, well, I am a minister. I should be able to be blessing people. I need to practice that one. Forgiveness. This is another strategy to practice forgiveness. In the Jewish faith, we have a concept of tikkun olam, and that's healing the world. Find yourself a good mantra and live it. Explore that concept of meaningful. And of course, one of my biggest strategies is TGF TCM. Thank God for Turner Classic Movies. I mean, if you're watching too much news and you're watching something, it's just not making you feel right. It's time to turn on Turner Classic Movies. If you're reading a book and you're not feeling good from it, change the book, change the channel, get out of there. And as I said, get in a study. The loneliness study, though, does need a follow-up. So I hope they're going to do that. And the one last thing I'd like to say is that some things contribute to resilience, but end up making a person more conscious of their loneliness. So take care of yourself. Find a purpose and live it. And that's what I have.
Thank you. Lots of actionable advice from you, Marty. Thank you so much. I want to come back to something that you said toward the end, which was ask for help. And I want to direct that question directly to Dr. Lee. How do we know when it's time to ask for help, and how can we use professional help to foster our own resilience?
This is a great question. So, I'm a psychiatrist. I work with older adults. And I think what brings people to my office is, they've tried a lot of things. They've tried a lot of strategies. And I think, when the symptoms become so overwhelming or so distressing, or it's hard to do the things you normally do, it's really important to seek additional help. And sometimes it's talking to a therapist, sometimes it's talking to a psychiatrist. But I think what we're trying to do is, one big part of resilience is, as you've heard, it's dynamic. It's a back and forth. You learn something, you gain something, you apply it to your life and your lifestyle. And part of that is learning the self-efficacy, that you will be able to overcome what you're going through, or you'll be able to get through this, like we mentioned with the grief, and that you'll be able to, like I said, flourish. You'll be able to flourish even in a difficult environment. So I think I would just listen to your gut. I would ask for help, even if you're not sure if you need help, because I have a lot of people come into my office and say, "What do you think, doc?" And I say, we'll talk about it. And if they want to come back and see me again, great. If they feel like they have what they need and they sort of have a good game plan, that's fine too. But I would say low threshold for reaching out at all times.
Thank you.
Okay. Yes, we have some questions.
Here we go.
Okay. Are we ready? Okay, this is for Dr. Twomley, Dr. Lee, Dr. Zizek. What are the major threats to mental health that you see in older adults?
Yeah, we could brainstorm on this. I'm going to throw out pain as a huge one. Marty mentioned that too.
Well, so much of my work has been in depression, and that's huge as well. Particularly depression that's unattended and untreated, and people not seeking help. I work a lot with doctors. Doctors are the worst, and try and tough it out at their own expense and don't seek help. So pain is important, depression, critically important, loneliness, and grief. Grief is just a huge issue because it's part and parcel of our daily lives, and we need to openly face it, address it, deal with it, give others the privilege of helping us and supporting us in our grief so we're not doing it alone. Stop there.
Yeah, this is a little orthogonal. I agree with loneliness and social support, but I was going to also say our world isn't really built for people who are aging. And I think we need to redesign how we do things, redesign our systems, our buildings, our spaces. And there are some shining examples of places that are very age-friendly, age-friendly systems of care, age-friendly housing. But I think we need to think about how do we build our lives around something that would promote that more. And that's kind of what I'm hoping for.
Okay, here's a question that came in that I think Dr. Zizek would be great to answer. What are the developments around psychedelic therapies, especially when it comes to mental health and aging?
Wish you asked me that a year and a half ago when I was looking for subjects to volunteer for our study on psilocybin for depression. I think there's great potential out there. I think we're just beginning to understand the potential of psychedelics, but it's way too early to recommend psychedelics as a treatment for mental illness or for loneliness or for anything else. We really need to test its specific uses and also how to safely apply psychedelics. But I'm really excited that we are now entering those into our toolkit for study, because everyone here knows that our medications for anything we medicate for aren't good enough. For depression, meds are often better than no meds, but there is no really good med that treats everybody for depression and doesn't have a lot of side effects. So we need better outside-of-the-box treatments, and psychedelics have the potential to do that, and the potential to take a psychedelic once or twice or three times instead of daily for the rest of your life and have an effect. But right now it's potential, and we need a lot more study out there to really determine how effective they are, who they're effective for, and how safe they are with long-term use.
Great. Okay, Marty, You gave the crowd so many great strategies and ideas for coping. I thought it was fantastic. And you did it with such great enthusiasm. Are there ever days when you don't feel up to doing all of those things? And what do you do in those situations?
Well, Turner Classic Movies. And the joy is to see whether in how many minutes somebody says, darling. That's my thing. I see how long, and I noticed that in the 60s, they put the R in darling. But just keep moving. That's one of my real key expressions. Don't get moony, just keep moving. Don't get moony, just keep moving. Repeat until effective. And that's why it's so nice to have so many different strategies to try different things. Sometimes it's just, oh, somebody has a dog. I need doggy conversation. Petting that dog will turn things around. I cannot say enough about art therapy. Talk therapy is great, but if you have a good art therapist, it's not about creating a piece of art. It's about the process that you go through as you're doing whatever it is, whether you're painting, whether you're collaging, whether you're doing ceramics or something. And the process that goes on in your brain, the good art therapist triggering questions and thoughts. And then after the session, you have something to take home with you and live with that continues the conversation about whatever it is that you're trying to find meaning. And I was trained as a dance therapist, but we studied art therapy, and I cannot tell you enough how powerful it is to have some art therapy in your life. So, and then driving my convertible. I drive a convertible. I put the top down, and I wonder, what the hell have I got to complain about?
Well, that was a fantastic pitch for UCSD's Craft Center that's upstairs on the second floor that has an interactive booth to be able to create some art therapy. So with that, I want to thank each and every one of you for your time today and all your contributions. Thank you for such a fantastic panel, Dr. Twombly, Lee, Zizek, and Marty.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at UCTV.tv.